the definition that I suggested for artist. I said that an artist was three things. One, it was a person who communicated by a craft to other people. And by craft, I meant a language that has its own intrinsic rules, its own history, its own conventions, its own material. And when we talked yesterday, we began to be aware that that includes most of you, most of you. I'm sure that there are all kinds of examples of that artistry that you've thought of since that we didn't mention yesterday. But my next two principles of definition, if you were not here, will let you know that you very likely fit in it. The second is that the communication effects, that is, creates, allows an experience in somebody else, in someone else. Someone who wears the clothes that you sewed, for example, and the clothing becomes something of that experience. Somebody who dwells within the house that you built or that you painted. A few more examples will come in just a little while. So number one, the artist is the one who communicates by a craft. Number two, the communication creates an experience for the one, an experience, a total experience. He uses the senses, the seeing, the taste, the hearing, motion, motor senses, the dance, for those who receive the communication. And then the third part of the definition that I suggested was that the result of that experience is not just that the artist depicts or represents, quote, reality in the art, that the artist does not just, although these things are a part of it, educate or ennoble only, but that the artist creates a kind of a space. I said a womb, or I said a house, a dwelling place. That's what the experience is. It is, if you could make it spatial, if you could look at it this way, it's as though the art, when it works, for a little while, contains the person who receives the art, whether it's flower arrangement or what have you. And that through that art, in this kind of organized experience, this organized sphere, this household, this dwelling place, the individual is able to see and understand something of the chaotic experience that all of life is. Therefore, it isn't just the teaching of a meaning, it's permitting the other person to experience some meaning or some order in the totality of life with that art. I won't take much more time with that definition, but that includes a lot of people. I mentioned those who have told stories to their children have done exactly that sort of thing. Those who have written songs and played songs or have sung, who play any kind of instrument, have done that sort of thing, are artists. Then yesterday I took some time to say what it is we do, what we do as artists. And I suggested that what we do has profound impact. I take very, very seriously what we do, more and more as I get into my craft, which is writing. I take it more and more seriously. I said that we do two things. We are the shapers. When people dwell within our experience, in a certain sense, we shape the world for them. We give it a shape. We give it a meaning. If it was chaos once, within that art, it begins to become cosmos. Yes. So we are the shapers. We took some time to talk about that. And that dwelling place becomes something. We are also the namers. Not only do we shape the world, but we name the individual who dwells within that world. We name the one who responds to our art. And we name the furniture, the things that make up that world in which the individual dwells. Here it is a part of our art. By extension, then the individual is able to name some of the things that exist in the world itself. I don't just mean, but I mean that we name the sky. I mean also that we name emotions or relationships, subtleties, philosophies, things that people may not have been aware of before. We name people. We name identities. People who enter into our art and did not know their names so well before. Dear God, I hope they hear their names whispered within the art and know their name the better thereafter. I think these are terribly powerful things. And I don't think that we can be loose with them. Yesterday I mostly presented. Today I want to argue. It's almost going to feel to me, I mean, I want to persuade of a thesis. That's what I mean, argue. I don't want to fight. And I say it that way because what I'm going to argue for is not much argued for in art today, in the contemporary world. Most of the artists that I know believe that they need an aesthetic, a principle of the beautiful, or the order, how their art ought to be used. Most of the artists that I know suspect that to talk about ethics is beside the point. I'm going to argue for ethics. I'm going to say, particularly the artist, whatever your art is, particularly the artist, I think, has an obligation to spend time with ethics. Not only, I say, I want to talk about doing it well, and by well, I mean two things. Not only that we do it right, technically, that we arrange our flowers right, according to the technique of flower arrangement. And here comes, this may not sound so much like a bomb to you, but it really is. Here comes the bomb. That what we also do righteously. I think it behooves us to do our art righteously. I will cry that from the tops of the mountains, except that most of the people who should hear it are in the cities, and they wouldn't hear me. So I have to go to the cities to do it. We have a profound effect. When I was in the second grade, I remember that I visited the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago. And in the Museum of Science and Industry, I'm telling you the truth, at the age of 7, I experienced existentialism long before anybody ever told me that word, and long before I ever began to read that philosophy. But when I began to read that philosophy, it was familiar. There is in the Museum of Science and Industry a large shining metal globe which hangs on the lowest floor, and it is always circling. Do some of you know this? What do you call that thing? Well, pendulum, but there's another word. It what? Foucault? Okay, it moves from the motion of the earth, is what? The motion of the earth continues to keep it moving. It moves in a slow swing, not round, but back and forth, and then as the earth turns, it keeps its pendulum swing going the same way, but as the earth turns, it looks as though the ball is... If you go up on the second or third floor, you can see where the string is attached to the ceiling, high, high up. When I was in the second grade, I was on the second or the third floor. And I remember that I came to a place where I saw this cord barely moving, coming and entering a large black hole and going down so far that I could not see where it went. I didn't know that on the end of it was this huge shining metal ball swinging back and forth. But I remember that I had a full sense of wonder as I came up to that pit, that hole, that deep, deep hole. I stood there, and while I stood there, it was written on the underneath a shining light what that cord was all about and the turning of the earth, which seemed to me elemental and massive things that I was looking at, turning of the whole globe of the earth and had to do with the sun and the stars. And as I stood there and looked down, what I thought was a hole that went forever down, music began to play. I don't know where the music came from. I don't know if somebody walked by with a box, but I believe that the music was part of the entire presentation. And I remember word for word what the song said, and it moved me. It said, "Enjoy yourself. It's later than you think. Enjoy yourself while you're still in the pink." I remember that song, and I remember as I stood there, I felt full of a tragic awe. I'm using large words now. I didn't have the words then, but I believed that song. And I believed that this endless pit in front of me and this slow clock, this very slowly moving cord, was saying something to me about my life and the end of my life. Existentialism. Live for the moment, Wally, because you're going to die soon. You're in the second grade. That's exactly right. Seize the day. Carpe diem. That's what I was learning at the age of 7. And I don't think that I maybe was a hypersensitive child, but I wouldn't be surprised that many of you will find in your past artistic moments like that when I was, in fact, invited into a kind of a dwelling place. It was the result of at least two artists, the one who figured out this whole thing in architecture and the other one who wrote the music. But people were behind that experience which I had. And that experience at that moment to me was vastly hollow. It was terribly empty. I did not cry at that moment. I simply believed in my heart what I had no words for in my head. And when I say existentialism, I'm not kidding. That's what I felt at that time, that all there was then, and I better experience it then. We do a profound and powerful thing. Any of us, authority, any of us who are authors, that is, those with authority for other people, and communicate by some kind of a craft. We do influence, we do shape, we do effect, we do name. My mother used to come to my bed at night when I was a child and say good night. And I loved her passing well. I loved her so much that sometimes I could hardly speak it. And when she sat on the edge of my bed, I was overwhelmed with my love for her. I usually could tell her mood by her smells. If she and Dad were going out that night, she smelled so sweet and beautiful. That's part of my love. Part of my love is that smell. It entered into me, that perfume smell. Not just perfume, but the kids' gloves, you know, that little smell of leather that she would have had on her hand, which, you know how sensitive child's nose, you take that glove off, that smell lingers on your hand. My mother used to put bright red nail polish on. Those days, they brought it to a sharper point, real sharp point. You remember that? Like that. And she had bright red lipstick, my mother did. And she used to comb her hair back like this and up and down. It was dark hair. And she would sit on the edge of my bed and I would feel the weight of her body sink the mattress and my whole body would kind of roll in her direction like that, which seemed to me the chords of love, the bands of love. Not those words, but those feelings. And sometimes she would sing to me at night. And I said, my princess. In my heart, I said, my queen. I love those moments. And if she were going out, she would kiss me on my cheek. And she would hold her lips against my cheek long enough to do the, you know, so that when she left the mark of her love in red on my cheek. Yes? And I think she knew what she was doing, so that I would get up. If she was gone, she wasn't gone. And I would go to the mirror and I would look, and there was her kiss. There were her lips, there was her love, still there. I said, as I went to sleep, my princess, my queen. In the morning I woke up, still full of the sweetness of that moment the night before. And I would float down the steps into the kitchen, anticipating my princess, my queen. I would float into the kitchen itself, and the smell was different. Mom would be standing behind the sink and her whole gestures would be different. They would be have a kind of a jerk about them. Jerk, 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 right? But that's okay. I didn't notice that thing. I was still full of the smell of the kid gloves and the red lipstick and the red fingernail polish. And I would float up to my princess, my queen, and I would say, Mom, and get no response at all. Just jerk, 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 jerk. She's making sandwiches for lunch. Get it to the kids. There were seven of us. I was the oldest. And she, finally, I would take hold of her house coat, whatever she was wearing at the time. Her hair was not neatly back, or not red, and I would tug. I'd say, Mom, and this woman would round on me, turn down and say, Wally, where have you been? Marvelous power she used to get. If I am a poet, I get it from my mother. My mother was an extraordinary poet. The words came like liquid out of her mouth with powerful imagery, strong metaphors, you guys know. Her grandma. Wally, where have you been? She would say, you're late, and your room better be clean, and those socks better be up off the floor. I saw those socks last night, and my hair would curl. I would say in my heart, now this is true, this is not exaggeration, I would say in my heart, where is my princess? Where is the queen? And this, all I'm describing for you, it was what for me was a perennial, a diurnal problem. that at one point my mother was so sweet and good and could fill me with the sweetness of love. And at another point, all of a sudden, there was no vestige of that sweetness and that goodness and that love. I had a whole cartload of love and I didn't know where to put it. And it began to feel guilty in my hands. I began to say, what did I do? Over and over again to myself, what did I do? Because we would go back and forth between these. And so as a child, I would kind of wait to see, what is the smell? How is she smelling? What are the gestures? How is she moving? Who is she today? It was a conundrum for me. This is the truth. It was a problem that I could not solve, and it kept me constantly off balance. I constantly felt guilty because I felt I was the one who changed her, made her so mad. Manas Trefelt was my babysitter in those days. I remember that name. Manas Trefelt had the sweet ability to read stories to us. And one night, I remember that she read me Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. That story begins, there was a princess, there was a queen, something like this, who sat at the window of the castle sewing. It was snowing outside, white drifts on the windowsill. And she lifted up her eyes and she sighed. The story says, she was so beautiful. She prayed to God because she was so beautiful, but she was sad. She said, if only I could have a child. If only I could have a child. While she was sewing, the needle slipped and pricked her finger, and she bled exactly 3 drops of blood into the snow, bright red on white snow. I was lost in this story. I dwelt in it. And the beautiful queen prayed, let me have a child with lips as red as blood and skin as white as snow. And her prayer was answered. She had a child. 'Twas a daughter. It didn't matter to me. The child was me. And then she died. Not once, but generally every night. But the king married another woman, a witch, who was also beautiful in a harsh sort of way. So beautiful that she would, and this was a wonder to me in the story, the unnaturalness of what is about to happen. She would look at her image in the mirror and she would speak to it. That's not unnatural. I had done the same thing. I knew people who would talk to their image in the mirror. She would say, mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fairest of us all? What was unnatural is that her image answered her and her own mouth didn't move. That her image could talk to her meant that there was a split there somehow. That was very unnatural. It wasn't, as I read that story, and we need to be careful about it, but it wasn't so much that she was a witch, it wasn't so much that she was a stepmother, it was that her image talked back to her, that she was split. That scared me. And for a while in the story, all things went well, but the child grew up. And the child grew beautiful. The child grew to be the answer to the other mother's prayer, which was lips as red as blood, skin as white as snow. And so one day when the witch said to the mirror, mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fairest of us all? The mirror answered, Snow White. The mirror answered, Wally. In my mind, this was the solution to the problem of my mother. I had two mothers. I had two mothers, and this was easier for me to understand. It was an imaginary solution. It was one that used not reason or rationality. It was one that used my imagination. But I had two mothers, and that's why I said that the first one would always return again and again. And the second one didn't love me because I reminded the second one of the first one, because I brought the sweetness of that love and that beauty. Now all of a sudden, I didn't feel so guilty, and my rocky world, this chaotic world in which I lived, settled for me. I understood. Now, I have to tell you, there was a part of me that knew that this was pretend. But there was a deep part of me that pretended very well and lived it. I'm describing to you what happened. You know that this is a Grimm fairy tale, and those of you who have studied it know that the Grimm's fairy tales have made error with regard to stepmothers and so forth and so on. But I tell you this so that you understand how profoundly powerful is our art. In this case, it did have the therapeutic effect of making me able to find order in my household. I said I had two mothers, and so I could love the one completely, totally, and I would not necessarily have to be terrified or scared or uncertain of the other one. I could offer myself to the other one as well. I could, side comment, I could look not quite so beautiful. Have you read Dr. Doolittle? Do some of you remember this? I read Dr. Doolittle when I was small. This is the third example I'm giving you. They are balanced. In Dr. Doolittle, there is a moment. Dr. Doolittle is the one. You remember there was a movie about that? The push me, pull you, and all that kind of stuff. So you know what I'm talking about. It's something that many, many children read, I suspect. I read it. And I tell you, I dwelt in what I read. It became the womb. It became the house in which I looked out upon the world. At one point, Dr. Doolittle is caught in prison in Africa. And I'll just shorten it. And the prince, that is the son of the chief of a certain black tribe, has been talking to Dr. Doolittle. Dr. Doolittle says unto this prince, I will give you whatever you want if you let me out of this cell. What is the thing that you want most of all? I read this and I believed what I was reading, even though I knew that it was pretense and imagination. It was shaping me and it was naming the world. The black prince said, I want to be white. Dr. Doolittle said, I can do that. And I remember reading the cleverness and even appreciating the cleverness of Dr. Doolittle, who went into his medical bag and brought out all the potions, all the powders, all the liquids that were white and mixed them together until he had a dead white potion. And then at night, the black prince slipped into the cell and Dr. Doolittle invited him to bring his face down and to dip it in this potion so that when the chief's son stood up, he was black everywhere but on his face. He wore a pale white mask and he rejoiced in the fact that he had become white and he let Dr. Doolittle go, who ran fast before the white should crack and the black should show. I believed it. What did that tell me? What did that tell me about black people? What did it say was their highest goal? You understand? I dwelt in that for a little while, and my expectation then as I grew was, well, of course, American Indians, blacks want to be like. You call that prejudice. One more. Hi. But you begin to get the point. I'm telling you true stories, and I'm hoping you're remembering like stories. Our art is very powerful. When I was in college, I decided to be a poet. And I began to teach myself poetry by mimicking other poets. That's the right thing to do. There came the time when I decided it was time to write sonnets, 14-line poems, and I did. And I said, but if you write sonnets, what you should do is what other sonneteers do. You should write love sonnets. And I did. I wrote a love sonnet. It was very good. I gave it to a friend of mine who was a woman much older than I was. And then I didn't hear from her for a while, and I didn't understand that. She had been taking classes with me in college, sitting next to me in 17th century literature. It was like a week went by, it was like 2 weeks went by, and I didn't hear from her after I had given her that poem. And then I don't recall whether I called or whether she called, but in the dormitory I stood talking to her on the telephone and I said, what's the matter? Why haven't you been talking? Where have you been? Why are you sick? Weren't you in class? And there was a long pause and she said, I love you. And it was as though a horse kicked me in the chest. I never expected that. And that was the first time that somebody had said that to me apart from my own family. I love you. I stood almost gasping. This is a real thing. This is a real thing coming through the phone. It was love coming through the phone. And do you know one of the things that encouraged it? My art. I didn't love her. I wrote a good poem, perfectly hollow, and I invited love. Be careful. I do believe that we who are artists, in any terms, artists, have the responsibility, the requirement to think ethically so that what we do does not become dangerous. That's a word I choose to use on purpose. So that it is not dangerous, so that it is not destructive, but rather so that it becomes comforting or so that it becomes constructive, that we do not break down, but rather that we build up. Because we will have an effect. The better the art is, the more certain is the fact that it shall have an effect. People will dwell within it. It shall shape their world. It shall name things for them. And if those things don't exist in that world, or if they don't exist the way in which we name them, then we will have created a bomb for them that can go off at the wrong times. It can be a profound deception. It can be a fraud. We can defraud them. I argue it. We must think ethically. We must. And so I begin my lecture. Well, here comes the concrete stuff, and I hope I can go fairly swiftly here. It's very organized in my head. I don't know if I can get it organized to you. This word has become extremely important to me, the word obey, or the word obedience. I think that we as artists must obey, and I think we must obey four ways. If we lack any one of those four, there may be a problem. And here comes the ethical argument. We must obey the craft that we have chosen. I mean the principles of the craft. I mean the history of the craft. I mean the conventions of that craft, the materials of that craft. This means, I used to think that I could be a writer out of my own instinct, that all I had to do was to go late at night into my dormitory room and turn on Tchaikovsky's Pathetique Symphony, which was a very grievous symphony. It ends dying, and it would get me into a mood, and then I would just blah. Vomit a wonderful poem. I used to think that poetry was already in me, you see, and all I had to do was to create the right circumstance and it would come flowing out. Wrong. Obviously, now, I won't take time on this because I don't think I should have to argue this, huh? That it requires us to know the conventions of our craft as best as we can. The conventions that prevail right now. What is a sonnet? What does 14 lines mean? How do the words balance? What are the images? The conventions that come from the whole history of our craft. T.S. Eliot says that when an artist writes well, the artist affects the entire history of art, draws from it, and adds to it. Lewis is not joking. And that requires then that I know something of the history of my art. I must hunker down and labor. So, we know that. Let's argue for it. Obedience, I suggest, is three things. It means that we must have objective knowledge. Those of you who are up here and can't see me squeak, I'm saying it out loud, whatever it is. It must have objective knowledge of the craft, I'll touch those things in a moment. Obedience also means that there is a relationship, a living relationship, an interaction between me and that thing which I obey. Both of us are alive, but together we create a third thing that stands between us, a living relationship, an interactive, mutual, talking, conversational relationship. And third, finally, obedience means willing action in conformity with this relationship and this one whom we obey. I put it on the board so that I don't have to linger over it long. You can muse on it. Light, so the craft. We should have knowledge of the craft. There should be a relationship, a respect, an honoring of the craft and of those who share the craft with us. So flower arrangers are aware of some of the histories of flower arrangement and the people who have done it and appreciate what they have done. And then action that is in conformity to what the craft is. Number two, however, here comes the second obedience that I think is absolutely necessary. Drawing lines on the board. If I go, oh, like that, what do you think the people listening to this tape are thinking? Stomach ache. Second, I suggest, I think I have the proper word, that we must obey, and raw reality is what I mean by the world. I just put it there in shorthand. Raw reality, our experience. Obedience to raw reality means that we are very, very sensitive to the experiences of other human beings, to what is in this world. That I know something of the history of the world, that I know something of the external, the people who dwell in it, the internal, perhaps by my own empathy, what they feel and what they think. I cannot shut myself off from the experiences that you have and think that I'm going to create an art that affects you. Did you just follow that sentence? I must obey the world. By the way, this means, therefore, that when I write, sometimes I will write some things that will offend other people. Because I am going to be realistic. I am going to speak what is real. That's my obedience to raw reality or to the world. I must be in, have a knowledge of it, stand in relationship with it, and act according to what I discover in the world. The third obedience, however, is that I must obey the other. By the other, I mean the one who receives my art. My reader, my audience, the one who views the art, the one who wears my clothes. I must also obey that one. And what I mean by obedience is that I must have a sensitivity to that one's language. Not just to this esoteric language of my craft, but also to the language that this one uses on the street. Are you following? So that I watch you, I hear how you talk, and I learn how you talk better than you know it yourself. I must know it. And I know that you talk not just by your voices and the words, the English language, the Norwegian language, or whatever. I know that you talk by the way in which you are sitting, and how you put your finger underneath your chin, and how you dip your head just a little bit to the right, but give me a smile when you say it's okay. I know, you understand what I'm saying. I have to learn the common language that people use, whether they know it or not. All the gestures of that common language, what colors mean to you, what feelings mean, how your emotions show in your face. And I must obey that language fully as much. I must know it, stand in relationship to it, obey it fully as much as I obey the language of my craft. Theologians, likewise, right? Thinking that right now? Exactly. We have our own internal language, and we must obey that, and it's history in Heil's Geschichte, but when we speak to the people, without cheapening it or patronizing them, same thing. That's the third obedience, absolutely necessary. The fourth obedience, I will say, is to God. And by that, I mean that I have knowledge of who God is. This, for me, I'll keep stressing that, I'll come back to it, for me, requires a knowledge of the Scripture. And not just a passing knowledge, but an interpretive knowledge of the entire Scripture. I must know the commands of God. I must know God. It means for me a living relationship with the deity. A living relationship, not a dead relationship, which can create some very dead writing or dangerous writing. I mean a living relationship wherein I am in community. I mean a relationship through which I see the other, through which I see the world, and in which I celebrate with my craft. But I stress that. Now, some extraordinary writing has been done, and it is redemptive, and it is good from people who are not Christians. So I am not at this point arguing and screaming and saying the artist can only be a Christian. But I do discover that most of those artists who move us past despair to some kind of a redemption have in their mind some sense of the deity and some sense of order in this world. C.S. Lewis says of the mythologies of this world, they are the yearnings of human beings, and therefore they reach toward the truth. The only difference between those mythologies which come out of the human yearnings and reach toward the truth and our true mythology is ours happened. He said, ours happened. So Lewis has no problem recognizing the four obediences in many, many other artists. And other people of the church have recognized that as well. We do not need to only read Christians. Nevertheless, with all my heart, I argue some kind of a relationship with this sense of the creator or the deity to create that kind of art which does not destroy other people. These four obediences, I think, are necessary. They require of us artists virtues. I would say, first of all, that there is a sort of a series of general virtues that I... Do you know how silly I would sound at certain secular universities at this point? Requiring of the artist virtue? And yet I do. We'll see why in just a minute. The three I identify for myself, at least, and I would offer to any other artist, three virtues that I think are necessary. And you see how all this becomes of a piece, that the virtues really do come from the breathing of the Holy Spirit into me. And yet, as I stand in relationship to God, so the order I create in my writing, in which you dwell, is created by faith. My Weltanschauung, my way of seeing the world, comes through that holy history of God, you see. That's how I begin to understand its meaning. And it will show in my writing, whether I'm conscious of it or not, so long as I am in these four obediences. But there are three virtues. I think one virtue absolutely necessary, required of us as artists, is humility. That we are not the center of our world and we are not the deity that we are presenting to others. Humility, I think, is required so that we may obey craft, the world as we see it, the audience unto whom we work, and the deity above all, in all, and through all. Humility, requirement of the artist. This isn't very exciting, huh? Should be. Second, courage. Courage, by that I mean the ability to take rash action. Courage, a large heart, a strong heart. She has a strong heart, the Indian would say. Courage, courage. I think we need courage. Because always obedience lacks a little knowledge. And always when we are obeying other things, we're not quite sure where we're going to end up. And where we end up may frighten us because it's a darkness until we have gotten there. Some of the writers say, I can't tell you which poet said this, they said, what are you going to write in this poem? And she said, how can I tell you what I'm going to write till I've written it? How do I know where I'm going till I'm there? And the artist is always on that Kierkegaardian edge of darkness. It's true. But we have shape, we have form, we have things we are obeying. And the third overall virtue that I would argue for is patience. Is that funny? Oh, it's serious, isn't it? Because none of the knowledge of any of these things comes quickly. They come slowly. That's why I keep stressing relationship. They come very, very slowly. And the process of art itself sometimes explodes. Sometimes God gives us, I think, this extraordinary gift of a line that wrote itself. Sometimes, but not often. Most of the time, I'm beating at that typewriter and I'm using all of my intellect, not much of my emotion. I'm working very, very hard. And what I have produced then, which took its own time, but you see all the obediences preceded that, needs to be revised. And it has to be revised according to my knowledge of the totality of my art. Patience. Patience. And partly because I finally begin to realize that my opus, my work, is not just the Book of the Dun Cow or this poem or that. It's all my work together. And so I may not ever see the final conclusion of all that I do. It requires of me patience. If I get too jerky and nervous and leap, I will present things that lack obedience. And I have done that. I've done that a lot, put out in public things that are not the result of complete obedience. But then, the virtues that are required underneath each of these, here I crept in on craft, and I use the word virtue still, I think for obedience to the craft we do, the virtue is, yes, discipline, is integrity, is sticking to it, is the ability to imitate. Ben Jonson, speaking of what it takes to become a poet, says that the learning poet should find the best poets that exist and imitate that poet. Imitate, imitate, imitate until you have, this is Ben Jonson's quote, until you have become a very he. Until you write exactly as that person writes, but not, he says, slavishly, but rather so that you have learned the whole craft so that from that point you can begin to write. That takes discipline. Industry was another word I would put underneath there. Do you know what virtue it takes to obey the world? Objective honesty. And I oppose that to prejudice, which means prejudging. The virtue here means that as I look at the world, I do not interpret what I see before I see it. I do not anticipate. I wait. Listen to me. All the world of God and every human being in it is a mystery. And that mystery must always be maintained, and I should stand in holy awe before it. If you are mysteries, then I will not presume on you. I will wait upon you, in the best sense of that word. I will wait until you have revealed the characteristics in you. Now, it's this kind of honesty, these virtues applied to the world, which gives me the ability to look at the crap in the world. I would use stronger language. And to know that it exists. If my religiosity is too narrow and sentimental and sweet, I won't even see it. I will say, woo. But when I write, I will not redeem what exists. I will redeem some imaginary something that I made up. It requires honesty. Specific honesty. I keep using right. I hope you keep translating that into your own kinds of art. Even the one who arranges flowers should know how colors look in this world anyway, even when they are ugly and the ugliness is true. There never was a forgiveness that was real except there was a sin. For the other, the virtue which is required of me, I keep using that word on purpose. And you know this is sanctification. You know this is what we strive toward. And I know that I'm not there, but at least I have the pattern. This is the virtue. Love. And I mean that in the Christian sense, not the worldly sense. It is required of me that I love those for whom I write, even if I have never met you. But as I sit down to write, that there is that sense. This Christian love is sacrificial love. I oppose that to arrogance, to self-centeredness, to the romantic notion that I am the best topic of my art. Which, by the way, is a notion that is resurrected in every college student who sat down to write. And I'm going to tell you the truth about me. And I read this paper, this wonderful poem, which is the truth about that specific person. And I say, well, that's well written, but then I don't quite say it so lies, but I don't care. You better be important before I want to read this about you. Tell me about the world in which I live. Tell me about what you have perceived. These four obediences are necessary, that you don't just write about yourself. Love means sacrificial, that I become more and more empty in my obedience, that you, with the world, and the ordering God take up place in the thing that I do. And finally, the virtue required so that I maintain relationship with God is my faith. Faith means objective. Objectively, that I understand. I mean the noun faith, that which we believe. That I understand what we believe. It's objective. It means that I understand what God has done in the world so that I can understand the character of God. But faith also means a persistent and living relationship with that God, with that deity. I think that is required. And suddenly that casts me into the whole business, I'll say this and I'll move away from it, of piety. Strangely enough, I think it behooves the artist to begin to build a pious life, even though that's come under all kinds of fire within as well as without of the church. Devotion is not unimportant to the artist. Prayer should not be conceived of as unimportant. Huh. Dangers, if these things do not exist. Well, if I do not obey my craft, I probably do not have art. That's the danger. That's the best, easiest, simplest, sweetest danger I have to talk about. If you are going to disobey any of these things, go ahead and disobey your craft, and then we just don't have to care about you. That sounds very nasty. What I mean is, it probably won't work anyway. Unless you learn your craft. And then the only one who is going to suffer will probably be you, wondering why it isn't working. And once again, I say, this is at the very beginning of the art. So often the young artist just presumes, I have so much to say, and this much is me. Have you ever noticed what it's like when somebody comes down in the morning and tells you their dream, as I still do again and again? And they can tell it to you in precise detail all the way through, and they get very excited, very happy, very sad by the dream, and you don't care? It's the most uninteresting thing in the world to hear somebody else's dream, but they're involved in it. Well, you know, that's what happens when we cease to obey the craft. If we don't obey the world, If we write something that is very crafted, excellently crafted, that cares about the other and that cares about God, but we don't obey what is the fact of the world, we may write something that nobody else can understand or that cares about. Or, I would put it this way, we would write propaganda. I mean, there are several problems that I can see here. In other words, if I do prejudice the world, if I do not clearly see what the world is and what others are, if I impose upon the world my own image and I write powerful art, I can persuade you to prejudices, as the Dr. Doolittle story did. See, the guy who wrote Dr. Doolittle did not obey the world. That guy was obeying his own sense of what black people are. And then he put that into a book and he gave it reality. He gave it a name and he gave it shape. We have propaganda that can become extremely destructive to other people. That's one thing that would happen if we don't obey the world. I made notes so that I don't miss these things here. But I'm getting old and I can't see close up. Or else we will write lies. We will write lies among the religious. We will write sweet lies, sentimental lies that will persuade nobody of our gospel, because they are simply not in harmony with the world that other people know. Or we can write dangerous lies. We can write those kind of lies that impose prejudices upon other people. Or it's possible that we may write simply out of vanity if we don't obey the world. And we will create something, what I write here, I call a sort of autistic art. A thing that stands totally on its own, separated from what is the experience of all other human beings. Obey the craft. Obey the world. Observe. Be honest with what you see. Be exceedingly sensitive. Be rash. Live on the edge. Don't make judgments before the details are in. But obey the other's language as well. If I write beautifully and am writing the truth about human experience, that's what obeying the world means, and I love God, but I don't take time to learn your language, then I become elitist. And my material becomes so esoteric, it doesn't move anybody at all. 'Twas brillig, and the slithy toves, de gyre, and gimble in the wave. All mimsy were the borogoves, and the mome raths outgrabe. Did I just make sense? I just made nonsense. It's a game. I mean, it's a game. It was meant to be nonsense. But if I start using those gestures, and I start using the language that you are aware of, I can make that poem mean something to you. I can deliver it to you only if I deliver it to you in your language. 'Twas mimsy and the boar... how does that start? 'Twas brillig and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the boar groves and the mome wraths outgrabe. Beware the jabberwock, my son. The jaws that bite, the claws that catch. Beware the jubjub bird and shun the frumious bandersnatch. He took his vorpal sword in hand. Long time the maxmome foe he sought. Then rested he neath a tum-tum tree and stood a while in thought. And as in oofish thought he stood, the jabberwock with eyes aflame came whiffling to the tulgey wood and burbling as it came. One, two, and through his vorpal blade went snicker-snack. He left it dead. And with its head, he went glomping back. Ah, hast thou killed the Jabberwock? Come to my arms, my beamish boy. Oh, frabjous day, calloo, calay. She chortled in her joy. 'Twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogoves, and the mome raths outgrabe. Oh, well. What? You get the point? What I began to do as I went with that poem was to give more and more of the language that acknowledges you. I need to know your language. If I didn't, then I could have given you profound esoterica and you would have said, whoa, dummy. Isn't that an amazing thing? If I obey the craft, the world, and God all exceedingly well so that I am near unto a genius, but I do not know your language, and I should be up here. You say, dummy. All my work is for naught. I am a fool. I am an idiot. And then finally, if we do not obey God, I say this. But we obey the craft, the world, and the other. But there is no deity dwelling in it. I say that we present our readers or whoever with a beautiful box, which is empty. Beautiful in filigree, wonderful to touch, and absolutely hollow. It is an enticing box. It makes them believe what they will find inside. It makes them deliver unto what they will find inside their hearts. And when they open it up and find nothing, one of two things happens. Either they despair because they believe in nothingness, meaninglessness, nonsense, the absurdity of this existence. Or the other thing, which may be worse, is that they fill the box with their own nonsense. They fill your beautiful and hollow box with their own presumptions already. And then they take your box and they say, "See, see, this," says Hitler, "this supports what I've been telling you all along." And what they fill the box with is their sin. Do you hear me? I think that's terribly dangerous. Because we've made no commitment whatsoever unto redemption, wholeness, holiness in the art. And that gives that art unto people to manipulate it as they will, and they can split it two ways. And both sides will use the same art against the other. I told you I was going to preach. Let me give you an example in the short time that we have left. I tell you that this is what I will do is tell you a story. And I will invite you to dwell in my story. It will be an example, but at the same time it will be an example of an example. I have to prepare you a little bit. I have to break it a little and speak something of my obedience to God in preparation for this story, and then hopefully you will understand by the time the story is done. Let me just say one or two things about God. There was a time when the glory of God was the Hebrew word gavod. Gavod. That I might call an old covenant glory. It's the glory of Mount Sinai, yes? With the crackling of power, the wrappings of clouds, thunder and lightning around it. The Hebrew word gavod, which we translate glory in the Old Testament, has the image of weight. Gavod. It is as though we say, he throws his weight around. It's authority. And if I just give you a fast skim of that old glory, we have to say this. We have to say that every time God imposed that glory upon the people, they didn't change. Old Israel remained exactly what it was. For all the threats, all the imposition, all the outside punishments that God not only threatened but delivered to them. This is an external thing, this glory. It's as though God remains up high in heaven and says, "All right, do this, and if you don't do that, you're going into exile." And they didn't, and they went into exile, and they changed it a little while, and they came back, and then they were the same. This is the glory of the law, I say that the law can restrain, and the law can contain, and the law can blame, and the law can shame, and the law can enrage, but the law does not change anybody. Even though the glory behind the law is the deity, is God of Sinai. But Jesus has changed glory into glory. Because Jesus did not count equality with this God a thing to be held on to, but Jesus emptied himself and took the form of a servant, human being among us. You see, this is this imposition, now all of a sudden enters in and becomes a part of the people, becomes a slave, humbles himself. Jesus humbled himself unto death, even death on a cross. This is a new glory. It's doxa, Greek word doxa. Its image is not weight. It is not this overwhelming authority. It is light. It is the shining from within. It doesn't impose. It exposes. It exposes what was there. And how does it do that? By God's appearing, and this is doxa fits with the Greek word dokein, which means appearing or seem, with God's appearing in places where you never expected it and crying with you your own suffering. Empathetic glory. This is Jesus appearing at places where you were dying and you expected nobody else to be there, least of all God. And there is God, not only, are you with me? Not only recognizing your suffering, but suffering it with you, and you see that in the holy face. That's the conciliatory, shining glory of Jesus. It's empathetic. It doesn't pound you. It weeps with you. And that was the first time that the people as a whole were changed from this loving, merciful glory. I'll tell you a story. True. It's a story past, and Matthew said I could tell it to you because I asked. When Matthew was very young, he was full of energy, mildly hyperactive. Mildly hyperactive means, let's see, in a medical way, parents go crazy. Matthew could, when we watched football games when he was little, 5 years old, he could not only squat down and be the guy who hiked the ball, he could in a flash be the quarterback. And as soon as he was the quarterback and had the football in his hand, he threw it. And in a flash, he was the wide receiver who was receiving the same football that the quarterback had thrown, that the hiker had done it. And he did this all within the same living room. And then when he received the ball, he became the tackler from the other team who took himself down on the floor against the wall all at once. Much, much excitement. Well, the other one characteristic of mild hyperactivity, too, is that a person has extreme loyalties, marvelous loyalties that are unbudgeable. You cannot remove these loyalties. They last forever and ever almost. You can't change them. You wish you could sometimes change them, but you can't. And I remember, I don't remember what grade, but I remember going into the boys' bedroom one night, and I was going to pray with them. Good night. And I looked down and I saw in the bottom drawer of Matthew's dresser, comic books. The boy had conceived loyalty to comic books. Only there were many comic books in that drawer. I don't know, I would say something like about 762 comic books. Or maybe that's an exaggeration. But when I looked at them, I saw that every single one of the comic books had a stamp on the front of it. It said, Evansville Vanderburgh County Library. I said, Matthew, did you get these from the library? He said, yes, I meant one thing. He meant another. They were Matthew's. He had taken them from the library, and he was building up for himself a marvelous collection of comic books because he had conceived a loyalty to comic books. And I suppose I could empathetically get inside of Matthew and understand that. Here is a boy with strong desire for comic books. Here, right across the street from us in the library, are many comic books, and nobody is saying no. And so comic book after comic, pile after pile, they crossed the street from the library to our house. And I was nervous. I was worried. I said, what is this saying about my son? What is this showing on the inside of him? What kind of tendencies? Stealing? How can we change this child so that this doesn't become a habit with him? And I had a wonderful idea. The librarian at the library from which the comic books had come is named Carolyn Outlaw. She stands fully as tall as I do, and she is a righteous woman. I mean, she is righteous. If you have gotten on her wrong side and she swells in front of you, she can stand as tall and as wide as Mount Sinai. And then it is as though the smoke were wrapping her head. Wild eyes, huge nostrils. Those nostrils can flare and look like chimney pots out of which the law of God comes on two tablets. I went over to Carolyn Outlaw. I said, Carolyn, have you noticed anything about the comic book? She said, yes, they're missing. I said, we have a problem. But you can solve it. I said, I wonder if perhaps you could talk to Matthew. And she began to swell in front of me. Well, you see, I wanted Matthew to know that the law was not just a Wandgren law. I wanted to know it was him to know it was a universal law, and I figured that Carolyn Outlaw could do that. She could do that very well. She said, yes, I will talk to him. I went home, and I got my son, and we got the comic books, and I have a picture of us coming out of the front door of the house. Little kid, wide eyes, stacks of comic books. His eyes are right over the top of those comic books. And who's nervous? I'm nervous. I know Carolyn Outlaw. We mounted the steps of the old library, went inside, and there was Sinai standing behind the counter. Matthew lifted his comic books and plunked them down there. Mrs. Outlaw didn't even look at me. She said, "Excuse us, please." And I left. I crept out of the library and I started pacing up and down in front. Well, I left my son in there, you know, with Mount Sinai. It can crackle lightning. It can do all kinds of noisy things. And I know the power she has. I tell you, Mrs. Outlaw can move people who are drinking or smoking, and they may be bigger than her, but she can move them car and all down the street. The door creaked open, and out came the little kid, my son Matthew, with his eyes very wide down the stairs. And we walked side by side back to the house, and I said, "Did Mrs. Outlaw talk to you?" And he said, I said, "Did you understand what she said?" And he said, "Yeah." I said, "Will you ever do it again?" He said, "No." I said, "Thank you, Jesus." I don't know if it was the next summer, maybe the following summer, but I went to St. Louis to teach, and I took my family with me, and we stayed in an apartment. Across the street from the apartment was a park. They could play there. Around the corner from the apartment was a drugstore. They shouldn't go there. But I didn't even know it was there to tell them don't go there. Matthew knew. And when we got home again and it was too late for me to tell him to take them back, I found in the bottom drawer of the dresser comic books! Shining new comic books this time with nobody stamp on them whatsoever. They had come from the drugstore, which was in St. Louis, too far away for me to get them. Had simply walked out of the store with him. Now I'm nervous. Number two time, you see, begins to look like a trend. And I'm a pastor, and I'm telling other people how to raise their children. I am very scared. What am I going to do now? Than always prayed that we would meet our children in heaven. I always prayed that we would never meet our children in jail. I had to take stronger measures than Mrs. Outlaw to change my son. And I did. Dramatic. My mother, you see. My mother was a dramatic, creative disciplinarian. Remember I told you about her poetry? She would say something magnificent and wonderful, and then she would do it because she was both a poet and a German. Once she'd made the promise, you see, she couldn't back out of it. She did it. She said to my brother, "What kind of egg do you want?" He couldn't make his mind up. She said, "You're going to get this egg one way or the other." He couldn't make his mind up. He got it. My mother threw eggs.